From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. About 20 years ago, Southern Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy stopped paying grazing fees for his cattle on federal land. It was an act of protest over what he saw as overburdensome environmental regulation, and he's been fighting the feds ever since. Recently, the dispute came to a head as the BLM attempted to confiscate Bundy's cows and collect the money he owes them. Hundreds of people traveled to the area to support the rancher, some of them armed members of militia groups. Earlier this month, BLM officials decided to back away from the standoff, but all of this seems to have reopened a debate over federal land ownership and states' rights that's been playing out in the West for decades. We're talking about that standoff today and what it tells us about that debate today. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Legally, the Bureau of Land Management had every right to confiscate Cliven Bundy's cows. For 20 years, the Southern Nevada rancher had refused to pay grazing fees to the government for use of that land. He said it was an act of protest on what he saw as overburdensome environmental regulations. But the BLM had recently won in court. They had sent him letters earlier in the month saying that he could keep the cows if he paid the fees, which by this point amounted to more than $1 million. But Cliven Bundy stood his ground, and things got tense when officials tried to impound the animals, and dozens of supporters showed up to support him. Some of them said they were members of armed militia groups, and in fact, many of them aimed weapons at federal employees at one point. Officials backed down from the standoff for now, but that battle, of course, is far from over, and it's reopened this ongoing debate over federal land ownership and states' rights in the West. We're going to talk about this story today, the standoff, and what it tells us about the debate today. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program is Jenny Lynn Merton, who is a filmmaker based in New York City. She co-directed the documentary called Sons of Perdition. It's about teens who have been exiled from their fundamentalist Mormon community. This weekend, Merton traveled to Cliven Bundy's ranch, and she's joining us today by phone from New York to talk about it. And Jenny Lynn Merton, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us a sense why you went to Nevada over the weekend. What did you figure you would find there?
I had actually was working I started following the story and started working with a photographer, Salt Lake-based photographer Eric Overton, and he had gone down the week before and was really struck not so much by the land battle or by even sort of Bundy's story, but by the people that had showed up, by the protesters. And so I decided to come out and spend the day, with him, taking some footage, and was really struck by the effort that all of these individuals across the country had made to, show up and protect this individual, this family. People had given up, work, had basically lost jobs, had traveled thousands of miles on their own dime, for, what they were calling, a principle.
Mm. How do you describe them? It's hard to be general, too general, but
yeah.
Give us a sense in general terms, if you can, of who they are, what they looked like, what they seemed to believe. What was your sense of it generally?
Well, the moment we walked up to this, it was essentially a kind of strategy meeting, and it was very sort of military-esque, and there were certainly weapons and tents and. And but here was basically a group of very tough-looking guys, all ages. I mean, this was not a young group, playing with guns. I mean, this was a mature group. A lot of the guys were over, in their 50s and older. They seemed very comfortable you know, in their, with their weapons, with their, you know, in the desert. And maybe not in the desert. A lot of them had come from New Hampshire and were having a hard time with the air. But they were, you know, they were kind of tough guys with, you know, with big principles. But, you know, as Eric described them, they sort of had, were big teddy bears. As soon as we started talking about why they were there, they broke down, you know, almost to a number, broke down crying.
Do you, I wonder if you, you've said that you kept hearing a lot of references to love.
Yes. And that's not exactly, you know, that's not a term that you would normally associate with a land battle or a, a military sort of rendezvous, or even a protest for that matter. But it kept coming up, and it came up in two regards. It came up in a love of, you know, principle and a love of country, and it came up in a love of family. And I thought, you know, so many of the people that we interviewed said, you know, I'm coming out here for my son, I'm coming out here for my daughter, I'm coming out here for their future because I love them and I love this country. You know, the moment we walked up, they handed us a copy of the Constitution. So there was, you know, it was the idea that love is unconditional and love is based on a principle, and that there, it's something that you have to be willing to make a great sacrifice for. And this was proof of that love.
Do you feel conflicted over what you're saying? Because on one hand, you could see what's going on there is this kind of genuine reflection of these deeply held beliefs they have about government and their families, those kinds of things. But on the other hand, these are people who have been aiming guns sniper style at federal employees who are just trying to do their jobs. And you have that kind of skeptical view that they're mercenaries in some ways, or just kind of overacting this part in a drama that they've helped create themselves.
You know, that's what I wanted to believe, and that's what I was skeptical of before I went out there. Absolutely. But I have to say that there was a lot less drama than I expected. No doubt they are there with weapons. No doubt they are, hunkering down for the long haul. But they also were very much like a group of very well-trained and obedient Boy Scouts. It struck me as, they talked tough, but you know, when a couple of their leaders got up and gave very inflammatory talks about, you know, fighting back to, you know, the federal government, they actually stopped clapping. I actually went out and had my skepticism, readjusted a little bit. That's not to say that there isn't a political battle here, that there isn't, you know, a possibility, but I think that they are questioning, and I think they would say to you, is the federal government just doing its job? Are these people just, you know, showing up and doing what they're supposed to be doing? And they made very clear to me, and of course I can't, prove every point on this, but they made very clear to me that they had told their group that they were to be respectful of law enforcement, respectful of federal agents. No one was to shoot, shoot first or fire first or even, you know, say a mean thing in order to they're there in a defensive posture is what I would say. If anything, I think you had a lot of, the young guys that were there that didn't have the military training were frankly terrified, and felt that they were making a big sacrifice and, you know, to be there and to stand on principle. So, you know, I expected to see a lot of gun waving, and that wasn't it at all. So it made me reconsider the nature of this protest. And the nature of one of the questions I asked, I said, is a gun always a weapon? And the answer I got was no, it is a tool. Take that for what it is, but it definitely suggests a different sort of point of view than it's very easy to put on this situation.
That's Jenny Lynn Merton. She's a filmmaker, founder of the production company Perpetual Projects. Joined us from her office in New York City. Later this morning, we're going to be posting the profile that she's produced of some of these protesters on Clive and Bundy's ranch. It was filmed by Jenny Lynn and by Salt Lake City photographer Eric Overton. You'll be able to watch it on videowest.kuer.org a little bit later on the program, later today. Jenny Lynn Merton, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us now on the program is Amy Cooter, who teaches sociology at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. She studies nationalism and militia movements, and she's joining us today from a studio at Vanderbilt. And Professor Cooter, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll try to get to some particulars about this, but let me ask generally, where do you situate this story in the context of the modern militia movement, if it even belongs there? These people who say they were in militias, do they belong in this general sense of a movement?
I think that they do. I think it's kind of a familiar story, frankly, with what we have seen with different militia groups since the 1990s. We've not necessarily paid a whole lot of attention to militias in the last decade or so, but looking just a little bit back more in our history, we've seen many instances where groups of people, militias and others, have believed that the federal government in some way is encroaching upon individual rights and liberties, and they see it as a civic duty to stand up and say, no, you can't do this. No, we're going to kind of stand in your way and not let you get away with what we perceive to be this infringement.
You know, it's interesting. If you one of the images that I think people are seeing a lot of is one man in particular, although I know a number apparently did this, in a prone position with a gun aimed at federal employees. Now, I wanted to ask you about that because you've said it's often the case that it's the extreme ones that tend to get the attention, but that the vast majority of militia members aren't these kind of crazy types, if I can put it in that way, that they're married, they have kids, they have steady jobs, they don't happen to be particularly religious. So which are the ones that we were seeing, the images of people with these submachine guns and things like that? Where are they? Who are they?
Well, from what I have seen of the militia movement, that is unusual. First of all, I think that the people who have actually gone to the ranch represent only a subset of the movement. As your filmmaker noted, the people who are on site tend, a lot of them, to be in their 50s. And most of the militia movement is younger, in their 20s and 30s. And I suspect that on site we're seeing more retired people, perhaps more military veterans, people who may have a kind of a felt stronger stake in some of these nationalistic issues. And in general, people in the movement do what your filmmaker also said. They think that they have an obligation to take a defensive stance toward the government. They don't want to be the ones to fire the first shot. They don't want to be the ones causing a problem. So unfortunately, I've not been to the Bundy Ranch myself, so I can't know for certain. But I suspect that the people that have shown up in those photographs aren't representative of the people who were there on site.
I want to play a clip. This is former Arizona Sheriff Richard Mack. He was speaking with the Fox News channel, and he was talking about something that caught a lot of people's attention. You may have heard this yourself. The strategy, as he seems to put it, of putting women on the front lines in this standoff. Listen to this. This is Richard Mack.
We were actually strategizing to put all the women up at the front. If they're going to start shooting, it's going to be women that are going to be televised all across the world getting shot by these rogue federal officers.
Now, is this bluster? Is this kind of a performance? What do you make of that?
Well, I think there's certainly a performative element to all of this, but I think that what's going on here is that some people in this movement feel like, first of all, that the federal agents who are engaged in this action aren't just doing their jobs. They're there violating the Constitution, violating what the people expect from them in terms of protecting and defending citizens. And they feel like that if they put women on the front, then it would be something that the federal government government probably would not take violent action against. And if they did, the media would not be able to spin it in sort of a pro-government fashion. So ideas about how the government would look as opposed to how the militia movement would look are behind statements like that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You've talked about how these groups tend to be less cohesive, less unified than a lot of social movements are. Wanted you to talk a little bit about that. And if what are the things, the characteristics that do draw them together? I suppose they have a common ideology in some way.
Sure. So I think that for the most part, militias are kind of independently organized, not even at the state level, but more at the community level. And within different regions, they'll occasionally come together for trainings and for other purposes. But it's not sort of this cohesive, let's communicate to all of our members one solid, consistent strategy that I think sometimes we imagine them to have. What they do all have in common is kind of an ideal libertarian outlook, the belief that people ought to be able to do what they want as long as they're not infringing on anybody else's rights. They take it very seriously, very personally as their job to protect those individual liberties. They understand that as being very connected to what it means to be an American. And so in that context, they're all very attentive to rulings by presidential administrations, what the federal government as a whole is kind of up to and doing. And events like this Bundy Ranch thing, where from the outside, if you're not there, if you've not seen the letters that have been sent to Bundy and the various attempts to seek monies over time, from the outside, this looks like it has been spun like an event where the government has just kind of without warning stepped in and tried to take away somebody's property. So events like that are definitely sort of a big catalyst for attention and for potential action.
How do you describe the relationship these groups seem to have with the media? Do movements like this go hand in hand? Because, you know, you're seeing kind of the emergence of more conservative media. Fox News is obviously the example that comes up from time to time.
Sure.
But you've also said that the militia groups like this, this seems ironic, I suppose, but they don't necessarily like or trust Fox News or any in the mainstream media.
Right. Most militia groups think that all mainstream news sources are in some way biased and not reflecting what's really going on. But I think at the same time, groups like Fox News in particular and some other sources tend to draw attention to potential news items of interest to groups like this. So they kind of also serve as a catalyst in terms of getting people's attention, maybe raising awareness about events that they might be interested in pursuing. And then that in turn serves as kind of a starting point for the conversation.
I wanted to ask you about the perception of these groups and the about the framers of the Constitution. Cliven Bundy and others have been making these references to the founding fathers, to this original intent of the country, of the Constitution, often referring to the Constitution, of course. Give us a sense of how that fits into this.
Well, most militia units don't see the Constitution as sort of a living document. They kind of think that the framers put it exactly perfectly, with a few exceptions that had to be worked out through amendments going through proper channels. They see the founding fathers as being kind of these ideal Americans that it's their job to remember and to uphold their values. So they kind of prioritize this originalist interpretation of what the Constitution means and should mean today when they look to government interventions and other people's actions too in terms of interpreting who's right, who's infringing on individual liberties, what should we be concerned about.
I want to ask you about if you worry, I guess the question is when you see people pointing weapons at federal officials, whether or not they're, you know, there's any sort of legitimate sense of their authority or, you know, however you parse the details of it. Surely you worry about this. But the question, I suppose, is, you know, are they bluffing or is there a real propensity for violence, something to just sort of go off at some point in a situation like this?
Well, with these groups, there's always the potential for people who are very sincere and violent and problematic. For the vast majority of them, firearms are not only tools, that is the word that they use, but they're also symbols. And for a lot of them, when they bring them to a big gathering, it's about sort of indicating Second Amendment rights, but also First Amendment rights. And it's kind of an attempt for them to remind the federal government that people care about these issues, and they're not going to just sort of sit back and take it in their view when those individual liberties are being infringed upon. When we're talking about pointing guns at federal officers, that does cross a line, and it crosses a line for a lot of militia members. So again, I think that that is concerning and probably unusual even for the people who are at the ranch right now.
Let me ask you this finally. Wanted to get your sense about the lesson that people could have taken from all of this experience. I mean, you have these armed groups that show up, tension gets ratcheted up. The BLM chooses to sort of take that pressure off. They back off for a time. And on one hand, you could say that that sends a message to these groups that their tactics worked. What do you make of the lesson that was sent by the BLM deciding, well, we need to back off a bit, at least for now?
Sure. So I think it's definitely a concern that you don't want to kind of reinforce problematic behavior. But in my opinion, the BLM did exactly the right thing by backing off, given the history we have with things like Ruby Ridge and Waco, where what kind of started as relatively non-events actually turned into really big, important, messy things where civilians died. And we saw these events kind of snowball in terms of what it did for the militia movement and for other movements. People use those events to sort of expand, to stay angry at the government. And in this instance, we didn't see that. What the government did was back off, sort of take a step away from the potential conflict. And as a result, I don't think we're going to see violent action follow, especially given that this event happened in April. April tends to be a contentious month in our history in terms of sort of the right-wing, quote-unquote, violence. Feelings run hot, and I think it's very important that these rational heads prevailed and sort of did not escalate into a more problematic conflict.
This is one thing you've written about, the importance of April in the scheme of things. So this is an important symbolic moment and could be fairly intense if it doesn't play out right.
That's correct. A lot of these groups really value different points in April for Paul Revere's ride and other events that happened during the Revolutionary War. April is when we have seen some of these other conflicts between right-wing groups and the government happen. It's when we've seen lots of different terror attacks, including the recent ones. And I think that these moments become kind of symbolic and can kind of ramp people up in a dangerous way.
That's Amy Cooter, a sociologist at Vanderbilt University, joined us from a studio there on campus. Professor Cooter, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take a brief break. Let me mention, later this morning on Video West, we're going to be posting a profile of the protesters on Clive and Bundy's ranch, filmed by our earlier guest, Jenny Lynn Merton, and Salt Lake City photographer Eric Overton. For a contrasting view, we're also posting a piece about Utah rancher Heidi Redd. In the late 1990s, she was worried about development, sold her ranch to the Nature Conservancy to preserve it. You may get two different views about land from those pieces. You can see them both later today on videowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're exploring the story playing out in southern Nevada. Rancher Clive and Bundy, of course, hasn't paid his grazing fees to the Bureau of Land Management in 20 years. As he sees, it's a philosophical dispute, doesn't believe that land should belong to the federal government. We're talking about the standoff that's going on there because, of course, Mr. Bundy has attracted a lot of supporters, people who say they're part of a militia in this country. A good number of them have come armed. We're talking about what this means for the ongoing debate over public land in the West. Joining us now on the program is Carl Graham, who's the director of the Coalition for Self-Government in the West. It's a project of the Sutherland Institute. You may recognize that name. It's a conservative think tank here in Salt Lake City. His writing has been featured, Mr. Graham's has, in National Review, The Wall Street Journal, Washington Times, and other publications. And Carl Graham, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here.
Well, let's start with I was interested in what is it that the give us a quick sense of the story that brought Clive and Bundy here in the first place, because it kind of goes back, again, 20 years. He hasn't been doing this for a long time, and it does relate to his sense of what he sees as federal overreach on land.
Yeah, his family settled that land back before Nevada was even a state. And of course, just like Utah and just about every other state, open lands upon statehood were reverted to the federal government. And so the lands that his family had been using and grazing on and settled and improved and all that was reverted to the federal government. So through a series of years or through a series of acts over the years that will bore people. Basically, the BLM comes to be in charge of it, and he has grazing rights to it, an actual property right with that land without ownership, but a right to graze. And that property right or that grazing right was eventually the cost of it, the compliance costs, and also the access to it and the ability to utilize it were decreased over time to the point where he felt that right had been violated in his case. And so he basically decided not to comply with the increased costs that the BLM was imposing.
So what's the story about for you? We'll get to whether or not he should have done what he did or whether this is helpful to your perspective in terms of this debate over federal land. But what do you see as the issue here?
This is an example, I think, of a much larger issue in the West that is now getting a lot more of attention that Utah is really leading the way on. And that's federal lands, the legitimacy of the federal government owning these vast swaths of land in the Western states. That hasn't been as big a problem in the past, but over the years, the layers and layers of restrictions placed on those lands and the inability to access those lands in ways that serve the people who live there has grown to the point where now I think we're really at a decision point. We've got to decide what we're going to do if we're going to see basically a rural production economy become something of the past. Or if we're going to allow that type of economy, that type of community to go forward.
But what do you mean? What you're saying is federal regulation has become so burdensome on these people that it's now having effects on their ability to essentially make a living?
Yeah, we're seeing access to lands that have been traditionally – again, we're kind of talking implied property rights here. All right, some people – recreationalists – I'm a fisherman. I'm a big outdoorsman myself. So I feel like I have an implied property right on Forest Service land to go fishing on a river, to go hiking, things like that. That's been built up over the years. But there are also people who have mineral rights and grazing rights and timber rights and all kinds of rights. And those things are really coming into conflict right now. And what we're seeing more often than not is in managing those rights, those often conflicting rights, we're seeing that a value system that favors the folks other than the ones who actually use that land to make a living, to propagate their communities, to take care of their families, they're the ones who are losing access. They're the ones who are being forced off through lack of access, through roads being taken out, through grazing leases being taken away or increased, or they're not economical, basically becoming willing sellers or even just being kicked off.
Let's take a few calls. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Michael is with us from Cottonwood Heights. Michael, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I just have a comment. Until 1976, Mr. Bundy could have homesteaded that land. He didn't do that. The reason I think he didn't do it is because it's federal land. Federal land does not pay state or local property taxes. And I know that that's the practice because I've represented a number of ranchers who simply said it's cheaper to pay the grazing fee than to pay the local property tax.
Well, talk about that question. That's an important to your point, this idea that burdensome regulation. I'm not sure if you include grazing fees in that, because I think most concede the grazing fees are not that high. But to this gentleman's point, this idea that Clive and Bundy was getting a decent deal from the federal government.
Yeah, but I think he was seeing – and again, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to go into every act that came along. I'm also not a professional economist, so I'm not going to talk about or I'm not able to really address whether or not the grazing fees had been raised to the point where it was no longer economical to execute them, to use them. But for the larger issue, I think that, well, again, he felt, and I think feels, that the federal policies put in place were meant to take him off of that land and favor one set of property uses and implied rights over his own. And I think that's the larger issue in the context of this.
Ideally, how are you and would you see this playing out then? Would you see the states themselves taking ownership of I can't imagine you think all of this land, but I mean we are talking about some 600 million acres of open land in the West that belongs to the federal government. So how much of that – have you thought about that?
You bet. The vast majority of that 600 million acres, that's 91% of all federal lands in this country are west of the Colorado-Nebraska line. So it's a lot out here. The vast majority of those have been designated over the years as the system of rules and management have evolved as multiple use. So that means recreational, aesthetic. It also means balancing that with development. The federal government has basically taken away that multiple use in increasing number of cases and made it just plain preservation. I have nothing against preservation and conservation, but they need to be balanced with human needs as well. And this country needs energy. It needs food. It needs the minerals that come out of those lands. It needs the timber. And so I think we've lost that balance. And so we're advocating the federal government turning over most of those lands, not all of them, certainly not national parks, certainly not tribal lands or deeded lands of the federal government, but or designated wilderness areas. But most of those lands that have been designated for multiple use, we think the states are in a better position to manage those lands for their best use, whether it be recreation or economic or whatever it is. And so that's what we'd like to see the country move towards.
Is that conceivable at this point? I mean, this is the one thing that you've talked about that seems to be the difference today. You've talked about the fact that you now have states that are passing laws or at least making efforts to get federal land back into the hands of the states. Is this kind of an emerging something that you see as an actual reality as opposed to something symbolic now?
Well, it is. I mean, Utah is leading the way with a bill that actually demands the return of federal lands. Now, is that going to happen right away? No, of course not. There's a process that it has to go through. Other Western states have bills and are in the process of studying the issue. I suspect we're going to see four or five of them at least in 2015. We'll probably pass bills similar to Utah's demanding it. And what that's going to do is that's going to continue the political and legal process of looking at the federal lands transfer and who's best to manage them. In the end, it's probably going to be decided in the Supreme Court one way or the other.
You see it headed there?
I do. I think it's going to end up there. Even if we succeed in the political process, if Congress – this will take an act of Congress. It'll take a law or more than one probably. Even if we succeed at the political level, there are going to be legal cases that come up and it's going to end up being in the courts. And it's going to take a while. And the Bundy case really just highlighted this issue. It certainly didn't start it and it's nowhere near the end of it, but it's acted as an impetus for people to talk about it, which I think in that way it's a positive.
So in that way it's a positive, but what about in the way where you have, again, imagery of people in prone positions with sniper rifles pointing at federal agents or Cliven Bundy saying that he doesn't even recognize the United States government as existing?
Those are not positives, and I'm not going to defend those actions in any way. But I will say that part of the argument about the Bundy case is one of its legality. Well, that's not really an argument. They broke the law. I don't think very many people disagree with that. But we have a history of bad laws in this country, and we have a long history of people breaking or ignoring those laws because they feel they're illegitimate, civil disobedience basically. So that's a larger issue than just is he breaking the law, or a more pertinent one. The second one is one of proportionality.
Well, let me stop you there on the civil disobedience one though, because I think you have these sort of contrasting examples of acts of civil disobedience. On one hand, you have Tim DeChristopher, the environmental activist who had an act of civil disobedience. But he paid the price. He went to prison.
Yep.
Cliven Bundy has people with guns who are trying to assure that he doesn't, in fact, pay the price. It doesn't seem like the same kind of thing.
Well, he is kind of paying the price right now. He's losing cattle. He's losing time. He's losing money. I can guarantee you that. And this process with him is
not – but he's free to come and go.
But it's not anywhere near over. All right. So – the way you enforce a property claim, a trespassing claim basically, is not to bring 200-plus armed federal agents with dogs and snipers. The property claims are generally enforced by liens and garnishments and things like that. That process is still to play out, and I strongly suspect – in fact, I fully expect that the Bundys are going to pay a high price for this, but it's not going to be through an armed standoff in the desert. It's going to be through the normal legal process that you'd expect for most cases.
It's Carl Graham. He's director of the Sutherland Institute's Coalition for Self-Government in the West. And Mr. Graham, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We need to take another break. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the broader issues that are at play in a particular story playing out in southern Nevada. The rancher Cliven Bundy has not paid his grazing fees to the Bureau of Land Management in some 20 years now, which has caused a standoff. The Bureau of Land Management backed off in that. And we're talking about this particular case, what it means for this ongoing debate over public land in the West. Joining us now on the program is Patrick Shea, who, as you may know, served as both director of the Bureau of Land Management and as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Interior for Land and Minerals Management in the Clinton administration, now has his own law firm in Salt Lake City dealing with environmental and natural resource issues. He's also a research professor of biology at the University of Utah. And Patrick Shea, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
We have Dan McCool with us as well, a political science professor here at the University of Utah. His research focused on water resource development and public land policy. And Professor, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Doug.
Well, I guess generally, let me start. What do you figure is the – I asked our guest earlier what this story was about. Generally, what do you figure it's about? Dan McCool, you first.
Well, it's not about militia. These people are not militia. The Constitution's quite clear on how you constitute a militia. It's to be well-regulated, and the commander-in-chief is the commander of the militia. These people are vigilantes. And what Cliven Bundy and his supporters don't like is the law. The law is quite clear. The Constitution provides that the federal government can make all necessary rules and regulations regarding its property. They have done so. They passed the Taylor Grazing Act in 1934. In 1976, the FLTMA, a Federal Policy and Land Management Act. So there's a very clear legal mandate to manage these lands. That's what they don't like. So they're actually extra legal vigilantes. They're not protecting property. They're not protecting a constitutional right. They're actually in violation of the Constitution.
Pat Shea, we've already seen some comparisons to what's going on in southern Nevada now to the Sagebrush Rebellion that was going on in the 70s and the 80s, this, of course, protest movement about public land and the amount of public land and the regulation of public land. Any connection in those? How do you see it?
Oh, I think there's a desire to create a bit of theater, but it's dangerous theater. And that's the thing I worry the most about is you take federal law enforcement officials. BLM has over 650 professionally trained rangers, and you put them in a situation where somebody, as you've said, lays down on the ground and points a rifle at them, and their instinct, quite properly, is they're under attack. And one of your guests earlier said that there are other processes by which disputes about taxes or AUM grazing fees can be handled. But after 20 years, something has to be done. And the regret I have is the dangerous situation that Mr. Bundy, wanting to be head of the theater, has created. And all it would take is one accidental shooting or intentional shooting, and you would have a bloodbath.
Carl Graham, who was on the program earlier, mentioned how states are passing these laws and making efforts to get federal land back into the hands of the states. What do you make of that? Is there some sort of movement going on, Dan McCool?
There's a movement, and it's based on a historical fallacy that once upon a time these lands were state lands. And unfortunately, there's sort of a collective delusion going on among a lot of Western state officials that this used to be state land and somehow the federal government stole it. That's simply not true. But we have governors and state legislators and lobbyists and people like Cliven Bundy actually perpetuating a complete myth. And that's very dangerous when you have an entire movement of people based on something that essentially is not true.
Patch, I wanted to work through some of the things that you've raised, questions about how we sort of got to this point. A number of points you've mentioned. One of them was this kind of anti-federal rhetoric that has fueled the fire over the past, I guess, several decades politically.
At least 40 years. And to me, Senator Church from Idaho put it quite well. We've had some politicians and now paid professional politicians who have found that fear sells. And so they're able to rally the troops by creating a fear element around the federal government, whether it's abortion rights, gay rights, gun control. It's the big, bad federal government. And the thing that I find interesting, having taught constitutional law for several years, is the idea that these 55 men who gathered in secret in Philadelphia have now been enshrined as being saints. When in fact, when you read the biographies of the 55 men, they had warts just as each of us do. And what they created was a remarkable system of checks and balances, but it was within a legal context, not an extra-legal context. We are not to be governed by vigilantes, and that's exactly what's going on. And when the governor of this state or of other states starts talking about state rights, they are historically incorrect when it comes to the Constitution, when it comes to federal lands.
I wonder what you make of another one of the dynamics that you've talked about, and I wanted to get both of your senses on this, is the kind of the lack of enforcement during the George W. Bush administration, Jr. Pat Shea, you start, but I want to hear you on this as well, Professor McCool.
To my mind, the Wild Horse program is the best example. When I left in 2000, we had it down to about 30,000 horses. The carrying capacity for public lands was about 25. We had a budget of $20 million. In 2009, when the Obama administration took over, there were now 80,000 horses and a budget of $80 million. So essentially what happened, whether it was on AUM grazing rights or on wild horses, was the Bush people simply did not enforce the law or the regulations that were there. And in Washington, there's a little thing called the dinosaur ache, and that at the end of each administration, some people want to put something down that will hatch on the new administration's realm. And I think the grazing rights is one such dinosaur egg that should have been taken care of in the Bush administration but was not.
What do you think about that?
I think what happened during the Bush years is that it allowed people to develop this kind of delusional notion of land management and the idea that states should and could and actually had a constitutional right to control these lands. And that should have been nipped in the bud, but now it's gotten out of hand. And now, unfortunately, it's conflated with a whole series of issues. The one point I think I agree with the vigilantes that showed up down there is that this isn't just about grazing and cows. I think that's true. I think they're misinformed. This idea that they're standing on the Constitution is simply contrary to reality. The federal government, the U.S. Constitution, is the supreme law of the land, and the state of Nevada can't pass a law telling the federal government what to do. That's the reality of the situation. What they really don't like is simply the law.
So it's a misunderstanding. I mean, they all seem to have pocket constitutions these days.
They haven't read them.
They need to read them.
What's the basic misunderstanding? Just that they don't understand the essence.
Let me put it this way. Yesterday we had a big storm, and the lights, street lights went out, and so people had to go red light, green light on an individual basis. You know, if we want to go into the Bundy world, there would be on our highways no green lights or red lights. It would be simply who had the biggest truck. And the law protects everyone from the least advantage to the most advantage. And if you start letting people determine what the light should be, we're going to have chaos not just on our roads but in our system of government.
I wonder, do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, let me just say that let's make sure we don't tar all the public lands ranchers with this. Most of them are law-abiding and they pay their fees and they're good people and they live within the law. They may not like the law. They might lobby to change it, but they go through legal means to do so. So Clive and Bundy, it is not your typical public lands rancher. He's an outlier, and his supporters are political outliers. They are the extreme edge of American society.
Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Drew is with us in Bountiful. Drew, hi.
Hi. So my question or comment, I guess, is that your last guest was speaking about individual states taking over the lands that the BLM or Forest Service or these type of entities manage, but realistically, our states don't have the financial capacity to manage these lands. Each state gets a subsidized entity of, or a subsidized financial help to manage these lands that create jobs, that create so many economical good things, that to switch it over to a state-by-state basis, we financially couldn't do it.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I want to hear you both on that. Ideally, let's turn it over to the states. How does it work?
I'm not sure ecosystems follow the straight lines drawn by 18th and 19th century drunken surveyors, which is how most of the western state lines are drawn. The caller is right. There are PILT payments, payment in lieu of taxes, that the federal government puts out through the BLM every year. And I do want to echo what Dan said. Most of the ranchers who use public lands do it in a very responsible way. And it's these outliers that create crisis, and then they are played upon by politicians who are seeking their own benefit as opposed to the public's benefit.
Actually, public lands ranching is very heavily subsidized. The public lands programs generate about one-sixth their management costs in grazing fees. And then they take a large segment of those grazing fees, and it goes back to states and counties. So if this land were to become state land, the state very wisely actually charges something close to a market rate. If you compare the $1.35 per AUM that public lands ranchers pay.
What is AUM?
Animal unit month, how much it takes to graze an animal.
So it costs $1.30-something per month per cow.
Yeah, or sheep or something
right,
else.
Right, whatever.
Comparable state land in Utah and other places is anywhere from $12 to $18.
Per head?
Per AUM.
Per AUM. And on private land, it goes from $18 to $25. So you're getting a great bargain at $1.35. And I remember when I was director, I took a huge amount of heat for raising it from 95 cents to $1.25.
So it's an enormous subsidy.
I want to get to this question of the tactics, the lesson that people could have drawn from the experience. Again, you had was it a good idea for the BLM to back off when they did, or does it send the wrong message? Dan McCool?
I think it was a mistake. And the reason why I think it was a mistake is because it is now rewarded aberrant behavior. It's rewarded people. So they now have been incentivized to gather at a moment's notice, heavily armed, and threaten to murder federal employees. And I just think there's going to be more standoffs like this, and that kind of behavior should not be incentivized.
This is something where you two don't exactly agree on.
I commend Neil Kornsey, the confirmed BLM director who's from Elko, Nevada, for having exercised calm and cool judgment. When you're exercising federal authority, you have time on your side. And every year there are at least three or four BLM employees killed while they're working. And there was no part of my job as BLM director that was more difficult than to try to offer condolences to family who had lost a member. Sometimes it was to fire. Sometimes it was to an auto accident. And sometimes it was due to vigilantes taking shots at them.
So what do you figure comes next in a situation like that? From your perspective, I guess, Pat Shea, you would think, okay, they've sort of tamped down the pressure for now. But you're seeing, I think if Dan McCool, you seem to be saying that you're getting people who may want to start to push these kinds of confrontations. So what is the thing that happens next as you see it playing out now?
They could hire me, and I'd be happy to file a tax lien so that any time they took those cattle to market, the federal government and taxpayers got paid. I think there are some judicial processes that can and should be used. But you have the San Juan County folks deciding they're going to take their ATMs up into a delicate desert area. And I think that is encouraged when people say, well, the BLM backed down. They didn't back down. They simply exercised calm, cool, professional judgment.
Are you worried that it's going to start ratcheting up, and not just in southern Nevada, but in the broader sense in terms of these disputes?
Yes. I think we're going to see more of these. Sooner or later, we're going to take the cattle off the land there. And the next time, I don't think there'll be the same number of vigilantes showing up. I think there'll be an even larger number because they've been rewarded for that kind of behavior. And I call it the Tim DeChristopher rule. If you do the crime, you do the time, right? And regardless of the political spectrum, if you break the law, I think you should be held accountable for it. And there are consequences, whether you're riding ATVs and illegally in canyons or grazing cattle without a permit. We have a nation of laws, not of men, and we should obey those laws.
Maybe Mr. Bundy will end up at Harvard Divinity School.
Like Tim DeChristopher had. Pat Shea, former director of the Bureau of Land Management and a lawyer now focusing on environmental and natural resources. I know you have to go, so thanks very much, Pat, for being with us. And Dan McCool, political science professor at the University of Utah, joined us here. And Dan, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Doug.
We're getting a lot of reaction, and we invite you to join the conversation by going onto our website. And a little bit later today, go to Video West, where we're posting a profile of these protesters filmed by Jenny Lynn Merton, who was on the program earlier, and Salt Lake photographer Eric Overton. And you can also see a contrasting view on the site, a piece about Utah rancher Heidi Redd. Go to videowest.kuer.org. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.